Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Wednesday, December 15, 2021. Some South Sudanese affected by the December 2013 violence are seeking for justice.
In that scenario, even now, I'm not happy. That's why we say that we cannot forget this day, but we can't forgive.
And South Sudan's national parliament has no room for holding its routine sessions.
So two ministers appeared, but unfortunately their presentation could not go through.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The spokesperson of South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly says lawmakers will not be able to sit for parliamentary sessions this week because Freedom Hall, where parliament has been holding sessions, is hosting a trade exhibition which began on Monday. South Sudan's National Parliament building has been under renovation since 2019. David Monodanga reports for VOA from Juba.
Paul Yuani Bonju, the head of Parliament's Information Committee, says lawmakers summoned five ministers and the chairperson of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission to explain what the government is doing about the floods that have submerged large swaths of South Sudan.
The speaker, after having listened carefully to the members, some honorable ministers were summoned. Those honorable ministers who were summoned includes the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management, the Minister of Health, the Minister of Water Resources and Irrigation, the Minister of Finance and Planning, and the Minister of Environment and Forestry, besides the chairperson of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission. So two ministers appeared, but unfortunately their presentation could not go through.
Bonju says those two ministers were sent back to write more detailed reports for Parliament, while the other three have yet to make their presentations. The Sudanese exhibition will not affect most of Parliament's activities because the MPs will have an extraordinary sitting this Friday to compensate for the lost time, according to Bonju.
Sudan is our neighbor. We have bilateral relations with Sudan. And if Sudan has asked for a facility, I'm sure as the government of the Republic of South Sudan, we have the leave to grant them that facility. So they were granted the Freedom Hall. And because of also this ad hoc committee report, then the ad hoc committee is making consultation. Tuesday and Wednesday, they're making adequate consultation, getting necessary information from some of the members of the parliament from the two houses.
Bonju says this is not the first time lawmakers have made way for an important event taking place at Freedom Hall, which disrupts proceedings of the Transitional National Legislative Assembly. Bonju noted the recent governance forum organized by the South Sudan government as one example.
When the governance forum was taking place, even it also affected some of our sittings. And this to us, we cannot say, okay, this is our hall, please move out. No, because also there are good things that the governors are discussing for the good of the community of South Sudan. So always we are very considerate. We are very considerate when coming to issues to do with sharing the Freedom Hall.
The Transitional National Legislative Assembly building has been under renovation since 2019. The project came to a halt when contractors abandoned work over contractual disagreements during former Speaker Anthony Lino Makana's tenure. Bonju tells South Sudan in Focus that technicians are wrapping up their work. He says most of the architectural designs are completed and the engineers are going to fix seats, audio systems and other accessories in the main hall, subject to financial commitments. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
Some South Sudanese are marking 8 years since conflict broke out in the capital Juba on December 15, 2013, between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. Some relatives of the victims of the conflict are calling on the government to ensure the victims receive justice. The victims are also calling on the government to restore lasting peace in the country. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
A Juba resident who prefers to only be identified as Chan for fear of reprisals from the government and other communities says he lost 5 family members the day the conflict broke out. Chan says he has found it difficult to forget the relatives he lost.
It was a tough moment at that time until we've been in that situation as a family. We were a target. We ran to UNMISS. So from UNMISS, we went up to that side of our country. So all of them, they were civilian. They are not soldiers. So one of my uncle was one of the students in University of Juba. So he was a citizen of this country, but he was definitely killed because he was from north. And two of my brother also, they were students. In that scenario, even now, I'm not happy. That's why we say that we can't forget this day, but we can't forgive.
Chan says his 5 relatives were killed in cold blood. He says besides his relatives, he misses some of his friends who were also killed in the conflict. He says he hopes that history will not repeat itself, but he says the perpetrators should at least be brought to book so that relatives see that some justice has been served.
The justice should take place because if there's something happened, the law should not be taken into hand. So the one that pushed the blood of those relative and brother should be held accountable. We, the relative, we should be happy if we see the justice that may took place. Plus, reconciliation and forgiveness is also the major factor that should follow the justice. Because if we leave them like this, we could even not feel happy in light time. Because it's not easy when you see someone that kill your relative or your brother and is still moving.
Chan calls on the government to establish a court to handle such cases. He also says authorities should focus on restoring peace and reconciling communities by bringing all stakeholders, including victims, to a roundtable discussion so that people accept their mistakes and move on as a nation. Riot Gatlong is a Juba resident who lost 3 relatives on the 15th of December 2013. He says this is a day he feels members of his community were targeted to be killed and raped, something he says he still feels sad about.
I don't feel like to call for the war again. No, let the past be the past. So we need peace in this country so that we can feel peace and unity, so that the young South Sudanese can live in peace and harmony. So we need hospitality among the youth of South Sudan. But the problem is this. The people who are coming, the people for peace, they don't implement the peace that we want.
Lamako, head of the National Democratic Movement, a member of the umbrella opposition group South Sudan Opposition Alliance, says 15th December is a black day in South Sudan's history as armed people went door-to-door hunting people just because of their ethnicity, while other nationalities were killed in revenge attack, something he says should never be repeated. A call says for South Sudan not to return to the same kind of war, the country's leadership should follow the peace agreement, especially the chapter covering truth and reconciliation.
The aspect of admission of guilt, you know, and truth telling, this is always the basis of reconciliation. So if you do that, you can reconcile as a country, not to repeat the atrocity that has been committed. But the judicial part of it is very important. There must be accountability, you know. And that's why the other component is the hybrid court, but also be activated so that those responsible for the crime are brought before the law. So nobody should be thinking in future that it can be some atrocity and then you can get out of it scot-free, you know.
Chan says only when peace is restored across the country will relatives of victims be able to forget the terrible things that occurred on December 15th and move on with their lives. Chan calls on the government to allow massive mourning every 15th of December for people to grieve for the love of their lost ones who died innocently. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
Lake State authorities say they have released 175 prisoners on Tuesday who had committed minor crimes to free up space in the congested prison cells. An official with the Lake State government says the freed prisoners served 3 to 5 years without trial. William Sande Mabor has this report for VOA from Rumbek.
Lagos State Acting Information Minister William Koji Kirjok says most of the freed prisoners were accused of minor offense such as failing to pay debts or adultery. Kirjok says the prisoners were released following a directive from Governor Lieutenant General Rintuen Mabor.
During the conflict, there has been a lot of mess, that including even misusing of powers. Some people were just victimized and they put in prison for a reason that which is not clear. And the current system is putting things in order. There were people being arrested over 2,000 and they remain in jail for some years. Others were arrested for 5,000, they remain in jail for years. So, which means it was not about 5,000, it is the ill intention of the hatred that people have among themselves. This time, such things will not be allowed.
Rin Maker Mading, Executive Director at Yarul West County Prison, says the inmates were released from Babur Zaid Military Prison and the Yarul County Main Prison.
We have released around 175 inmates in different prisons. We have released 82 in Babur Zaid and 93 in Main Prison service yesterday. This assignment was given to me by the State Governor, LT General Rintuen, to screen all the prisons according to the accumulation of people in those places without proper documents that kept them in the prisons. This is what was happened. We are still with a prison.
Mading says the prisoners were freed if judges are certain that the charges brought by the government against the inmates were minor or arbitrary, or if the inmates had been in prison for a long time without trial and the charges were minor, such as failure to pay debts.
We use two criteria to release those out. We have three courts. We have town bench court, which is headed by Sultan Apugi Makaintiel, and we have a T-court, which is headed by Maker Akwarjok, and we have mobile court, which is now headed by Adunatwin. Those courts, we call the people who have been arrested out and to screen them. First, we screen those who their cases was over. Also, we screen out those who were in detention without investigation or trial.
Mading says some of the inmates spend up to 5 years behind bars without trial, while some of the complainants live outside the country and send money to file cases against certain individuals but never bothered to follow the cases.
Some of them have 4 to 5 years, those who were in detention without investigation by those who detained them. Some of those complainers were, some of them are in abroad, like Kenya, Uganda, and other countries. They used to send money and capture a person and put them in prison without any investigation.
Local authorities say many people in the state have suffered from lawlessness for the last 15 years of intercommunal conflicts. Last month, the Lagos State Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Angelina Ding Mario, visited Rumbek's main prison and found many teenagers, boys and girls, detained at the facility. Mario said some people were in prison because of their relatives' crimes. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabor in Rumbek, Lagos State.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Human Rights Watch says the UN should look into the renewed violence in Sudan's Darfur region. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
What is the mode of travel you most often use to get to work?
Thank God I have a car for over 9 years, so I drive my car to go to my workplace. But sometimes if there has a problem, I use tricycle.
I usually use the many buses, but more oftenly I just walk from where I live because within the area that I work.
I have an old bicycle. I ride on it anytime I'm going to work.
I use the public transport to work most of the time because it's easily accessible and it takes me to where I'm going.
I ride in my husband's car to work. He has his own car, so every morning he picks me and drops me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Human Rights Watch says a new wave of attacks on civilians in Darfur since mid-November highlights the urgent need for the United Nations to enhance its scrutiny of the restive Darfur region. In a statement released Wednesday, Human Rights Watch says violence between armed groups has been on the rise and has had a devastating impact on civilians. The report calls on the UN to deploy a robust human rights monitoring system in the area, including experts in gender-based crimes. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Mohamed Osman, a Sudanese researcher at Human Rights Watch, says the resurgence of violence in Darfur over the last year has left a trail of devastation with scores of people killed and injured, massive displacement, and thousands of homes destroyed. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus via a messaging application from Berlin, Germany, Osman attributes the escalation of violence in Darfur to a number of things, including the failure of Sudanese authorities for the last 2 years to provide meaningful civilian protection and justice for past and ongoing abuses. Osman says since the military takeover on October 25th, attention has been focused on events in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. But for the past several weeks, West Darfur State has been a steep rise in violence in the Jebel Moon and Krenek areas, including targeted attacks on internally displaced people. He says to avoid these abuses from ongoing encounters, the UN Integrated Transition Assistance Mission in Sudan should immediately deploy monitors with gender expertise to the region.
These are all events happening at a time in which access is pretty difficult for weeks between October 25th and November 17th. Following the coup in Sudan, there has been no internet. And talking to local monitors in Darfur, that has been an issue because that created a gap or even created a challenge to the already challenged capacities of monitoring of abuses.
The Human Rights Watch report released today says dozens of people have been killed and scores of others injured in West Darfur's Jebel Moon area and surrounding villages. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan says more than 2,000 families have been displaced and have crossed into neighboring Chad. In December last year, the UN Security Council ordered the withdrawal of the joint United Nations and African Union peacekeeping forces from Darfur. Since that time, intercommunal violence has been rampant in the area, and Osman says the Sudanese government has failed to fulfill its promise to protect civilians in Darfur.
The push of peacekeepers created a vacuum in deterring forces. Now we need to fix the vacuum when it comes to monitoring on the abuses, and that should happen in a line with the international community also be able to refocus on Darfur. While they're engaged with the whole situation in Sudan. And we need to understand that the dynamics that we see in Darfur, especially when we talk about the continuation of impunity, are driving the violence even more and more.
Osman says the Sudanese government has done very little in the way of protecting civilians or taking legal action to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Despite the massive killings, despite the massive destruction of property, the response in terms of accountability has been almost non-existent. And that feeds into this vicious cycle of impunity that for a long time people in Darfur have to suffer, struggle through.
Under the Juba peace agreement, the various forces were expected to deploy a 12,000-strong force in Darfur within 90 days to secure the area and provide protection for civilians. Despite the signed deal between Sudan's transitional government and other armed groups in Darfur last year, an untold number of civilians and IDPs still fall victim of violence. Usman says the Human Rights Watch believes communities must practice social peace so they can engage in normal day-to-day activities like farming.
So the ability of the peace agreement to achieve that goal in terms of civilian protection definitely transcend the text there and require more of a holistic approach to be able to address the root causes of the conflict, B, include communities affected, notably the IDPs, into the next steps. We can't definitely isolate Darfur from the ongoing political dynamics that definitely still involve the Juba peace agreement itself.
4 days of fighting between Arab militia and residents of Misriya Jebel tribe between November 17th and 21st in West Darfur's Jebel Moon area left at least 50 people dead, according to the UN. It also reported that nearly 600 houses were burned and plundered, and more than 6,600 people were internally displaced, while more than 2,200 others fled to neighboring Chad. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
From Khartoum, we move to South Africa for some news on the Omicron variant of COVID-19. The first major study of Omicron variant of COVID-19 shows it causes less serious illness than previous strains, but is also more resistant to one of the most widely used vaccines. The research from South Africa's biggest health insurance firm, Discovery Health, has found out that Pfizer jab gives 33% protection against Omicron. But as Darren Taylor reports, scientists around the world are viewing the study outcomes with cautious optimism.
A team of scientists appointed by Discovery analyzed almost 80,000 Omicron cases. These were identified in the 3 weeks since genetic sequences in South Africa first detected the variant.
I think what's exciting about ours is that being at the center of the world's Omicron outbreak here in South Africa at the moment, we've been able to be the first to test vaccine effectiveness at scale.
Discovery CEO Dr. Ryan Noach told a news conference yesterday the study offers more than a few reasons to be hopeful.
The results show that the Pfizer-BioNTech double dose vaccine, in other words, what we would call fully vaccinated people here in South Africa, they have a 70% reduction in risk of admission to hospital after contracting an Omicron infection. So they are 70% less likely than an unvaccinated individual to require hospital admission or to contract severe disease.
He says the Pfizer shot offered 93% protection against severe disease caused by the Delta variant. The vaccine provides 70% protection against serious illness caused by Omicron, representing quite a big drop in vaccine efficacy.
This really reinforces the case for the need for boosters. We are strongly of the view that boosters will again lift this vaccine effectiveness number, perhaps closer to where it was.
Noach says a preliminary and cautious finding is that Omicron is indeed a milder variant than Delta, at least in the South African setting.
Our data shows that the Omicron wave that we're experiencing now is 29% less severe than the Delta wave. In clinical terms, you're 29% less likely to experience severe illness or require hospital admission in this current Omicron wave. We've heard lots of anecdotes.
He says anecdotal evidence from local hospitals, doctors, and medical associations suggests Omicron has several nuances when compared with symptoms caused by previous variants.
That illness itself is characterized by some of the same features, a sore throat, a fever, a headache, but particularly by myalgia, which is pain in the muscles. And a common feature actually seems to be lower back pain that a lot of people are reporting. Most people tend to get over this quite quickly. In hospital, we're seeing less respiratory distress.
Noj says medical professionals working with Discovery are reporting that patients who are vaccinated aren't getting very sick with Omicron. He says up to 35% of patients during prior waves of COVID-19 needed intensive care and ventilation. During the current Omicron wave, this has dropped to just 13%. But he adds, people infected with Omicron are still dying.
We're dealing still with a fairly large number and a growing number of deaths at the moment in wave four. So there are deaths. We believe they are attributable to Omicron. The majority of people in requiring hospitalization are unvaccinated. And in fact, about 90% of those who land up in ICU or high care are unvaccinated.
So says Noach, while it appears as if Omicron's milder than previous variants, it's still extremely dangerous. He therefore urges people who haven't been vaccinated to get the jab as soon as possible and for sustained observance of the necessary measures to try to prevent getting and spreading Omicron. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Still on COVID, Kenya's High Court has suspended a government order that required everyone accessing public services and places to be vaccinated against COVID-19 by December 21st. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Kenyan High Court Judge Anthony Mrima put a hold on a government directive that will have denied services to unvaccinated persons beginning next week. A petition challenging the rule was filed last week by businessman Enoch Aura, who argued the directive was illegal. Rights group Human Rights Watch has called on the Kenyan government to amend the directive and avoid directives that undermine the rights of the people. Adi Radish Krishnan is an Africa Research Fellow at Human Rights Watch. He says the directive will block millions from accessing essential services.
The requirement would risk the violations of the right to work, right to health, education, and social security for millions. You know, vaccination coverage hinges on availability and accessibility. And the new measures, as initially announced, could leave millions of Kenyans unable to access these government services, like going to the hospital in person, going to university, or going to an immigration office for their ID card.
Like most African countries, Kenya has seen fewer people coming in for COVID-19 vaccine doses in the past few weeks. In Kenya, 3.2 million people are fully vaccinated and 5.3 million individuals have at least one dose. Radha Krishnan says health protocols should be followed and people's beliefs should be considered on vaccine coverage.
While requiring proof of vaccination may act as a powerful incentive for people to be vaccinated, the way it is carried out should account for the numerous reasons a person may not be able to receive the vaccine in time. And these include social, political, or economic barriers. Any vaccine requirement should be implemented within a broader public health strategy that emphasizes accessibility of vaccines and other preventative measures for COVID-19.
With a population of 50 million, Kenya has received 8 million COVID-19 vaccine doses. This African nation has recorded 256,000 coronavirus positive cases and 5,350 deaths. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Ability by Radio and Whistle. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Sling, Kovambo, Joe, the rubber.
o'clock career. Done this for a while, me just shifting gears. Tell the enemies we no fear. You better get the wheel and steer. I feel it's opportunity, it goes to clear. But it could have taken forever.